Well, nice to see you all. And what a beautiful day to be alive. Feels like spring to me. Does it feel like spring to you? Just like there's this awakening happening. Feels like we turned a corner. When I walk on that hard ground, I can imagine that things are waking up and underneath, deep in the soil. So, and we have more light. So that's great too. So, well, today my talk is going to be about the refuges, and specifically about taking refuge as a Dharma gate, as an opening into more presence and being here with more fullness. So, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is the first three of the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. And it's considered a really important teaching and practice, and it's included in almost all Soto Zen ceremonies, even some weddings and funerals include taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so from Indian Buddhism, from the time of the Buddha, it started with people encountering the Buddha and saying, "Wow, what are you?" You know, and replying, "I'm awake. I'm a human being like you, and this is what being awake looks like." And the response from people wanting to be with him, so taking refuge in his presence, his actual physical presence, and then his teaching and the community of practitioners. So that's where it all started. And the treasures they're considered treasures or gems because they're so important, and they're shared across all. They're one of the few things that all Buddhist traditions have in common, is venerating or taking refuge. So I'm going to talk about the meaning of the word, the English meaning, and then I'm going to talk about four interpretations that contribute to how we understand the refuges, and then talk about some practices. And as usual, I've got a couple poems. I like poems, and we may even end with a little singing. So, the meaning, two meanings for refuge, a place of safety from danger, is one English meaning. And the second is an area that's set aside, like a wildlife refuge. So I think when I look at those meanings, I think about how taking refuge in Buddha and the teachings and the community is it keeps us safe from the tendency of our minds to gallop out of control and to be overwhelmed with clinging, grasping, you know, greed, hate, and delusion. So there's a sense of taking refuge is reaching out for a safe haven from that. And it includes a turning away from those things to turn towards our true nature, our unconditioned self. And I think also that second meaning is about protecting what is most unfettered and even beautiful in us. So that's Buddha, that we are. Okay, not Buddha nature, but just the Buddha we are. So from the early Indian refuge, the word is seen as asylum or shelter. And it's the most common that interpretation that you all know about. Taking refuge in the historical Buddha, the fully awakened one, as an example, as the one who showed humanity this could be done. The Dharma is the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and Conditioned Arising. And the Sangha being the order of monks and nuns, and later including all of us who practice together. So it might be said like this: I go to the fully awakened one for refuge. I go to the Buddha's teachings for refuge. I go to the community of practitioners for refuge. So that's what we're doing here today, in a sense. We are taking refuge together here. Down at Hokkyoji, where I live, we just had a practice period, and we were studying a passage from the Samyutta Nikaya, from the Pali Canon, called Stream Entry. And I was telling someone around the table in the discussion group that it's taken me a long time to appreciate the early teachings from the Pali Canon. I've been a Mahayana person for 35 years, and I find myself now able to with a group, because they seem to open up when you're with a group, to really enter more, a little bit more into those teachings and even see the seeds of the Mahayana in there. It's kind of amazing sometimes. You're reading one passage on conditioned arising that sounded just like the Heart Sutra. So in this passage, the Buddha describes a noble disciple of the Buddha as being one with lucid confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So I like that term, lucid confidence, as an alternative to faith or even reliance on. Lucid confidence, because in Buddhism, faith is something to be verified personally, and involves clear seeing and reflection. So let me move on to some contributions from Tibetan Buddhism. Their contribution is that there's two aspects, the inner and the outer refuges. So the outer Buddha refers to the awakened state and those who've attained it. Dharma is our realizations from our own personal practice and our experience on the path, our experience, our verified experience, realization. And Sangha is the community, those who have wisdom from whom we receive support and inspiration. So that's one aspect. And they say the inner aspect is Buddha means refuge in ourselves, our inner Buddha that exists in a seed form. And Dharma is our natural wisdom that's able to distinguish truth from falsehood and poison from medicine. And Sangha is seen as the guidance and support we're able to share with others. So it's really giving and receiving. And all three of the refuges are, we take them together because they're just interpenetrated and interwoven. So I see the aspect of both turning away and turning towards of refuge as turning away from my tendency to follow after my conditioning and my, you know, wants, desires, needs, and all of that, towards the perspective of I have everything I need, and there's a spaciousness. That's Buddha. There's a text called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, a Tibetan text, that asks this question from a very non-dual perspective on taking refuge. What is taking refuge? With a mind free from the hustle and bustle of the world. And it answers, by knowing all entities to be non-existent, to see them as incapable of being given form as entities unto themselves, but to see them as being perfected Buddhas, is taking refuge in the Buddha. Yeah, yeah. The question or the answer? Okay. Question. What is taking refuge with a mind free from the hustle and bustle of the world? The answer, taking refuge in the Buddha, by knowing all entities to be non-existent, to see them as incapable of being given form as entities unto themselves, but to see them as being perfected Buddhas, is taking refuge in the Buddha. Does that make more sense? So that's seeing that we're not separate. We're not two. So we and Buddha are one. We're one with Buddha. There's not Buddha and us. Over there is Buddha. We're just us. And it's also seeing with the eyes of seeing others as Buddha. To see all, and it goes on, to see all entities as following the Dharma Dhatu, or the Dharma realm, is taking refuge in the Dharma. To see the conditioned and unconditioned as non-dual, not split, is taking refuge in the Dharma. So that's like what Suzuki Roshi called, and I've heard Tim say this too, returning to zero. Returning to zero. Resting in the mind before thinking, which is really one of the aims of this aimless practice that we do. And a third perspective, according to Dogen. Namu kie butsu. Hamu means to throw oneself into, to rely on Buddha. Namu kie butsu is Buddha. To rely on kie, namu, throwing yourself into. So Katagiri Roshi used to call this throwing yourself into the house of Buddha. That sitting zazen or doing sesshin or retreat is throwing yourself into the house of Buddha without reservations. Without holding back. So they refer to having enough faith and confidence in what we're taking refuge in. And Suzuki Roshi said that the house of Buddha in this context is refers to the house of our true self, our unconditioned self. He used that term, true self. So, and in Zen, taking refuge refers to Buddha's our original nature, our original awakened nature, and the original nature together of all beings, together with us. The Dharma is the teaching of how to come back to ourself, our true self, our true home, the practices that we do, the methods, the teachings that remind us to come back, and the Sangha is a sense of interpenetration and mutual support with everything. And here's a quote from American Zen teacher Robert Aitken on that point of view. Sangha is the kinship of all things, every entity, and of all universes, past, present, and future, in every direction. Taking refuge in this limitless community is taking refuge in the Sangha. So that's broadening out our idea of what Sangha is quite a bit in a very Mahayana way. And I like Gary Snyder's poems because he includes so-called non-sentient beings and, you know, the mountains and the rivers and his immediate environment in his understanding of Sangha. So I have a poem that of his to read to you. It's called For All. Ah, to be alive on a mid-September morn, fording a stream barefoot, pants rolled up, holding boots, pack on, sunshine, ice in the shallows, northern Rockies. Rustle and shimmer of icy creek waters, stones turn underfoot, small and hard as toes, cold nose dripping, singing inside, creek music, heart music, smell of sun on gravel. I pledge allegiance to the soil of Turtle Island and to the beings who thereon dwell, one ecosystem in diversity under the sun with joyful interpenetration for all. I like that. So he's pledging allegiance, but he's also taking refuge. Pema Chodron says, on the other hand, that we are refugees. We are refugees. So we may be looking for a safe haven, but actually we're being home leavers in the sense of letting go of our stories and our conditioning, leaving the home of our worldly attachments behind. That's the rigorous work of refuge. That's the rigorous work. So it's paradoxical. And a fourth additional meaning of refuge that from some American Zen teachers is that of continually returning or recalling, in the sense of both being mindful and wholehearted aspiration. So it's like, what's the inmost call of our hearts? Being in touch with that, the inmost call of our hearts. And also just showing up to sit the sit, to hear a talk, to do the retreat, to take out the garbage and shovel the walk. That aspect of taking refuge is showing up together to do that work, which is all part of waking up. And here's a quote from an article I read in Buddha Dharma. It's actually about enlightenment, but I think it applies to taking refuge too, in this sense of just showing up for our life and for our aspiration. Just keep showing up, no matter what, with an open mind and a whole heart. Allow your allegiance to be turned from the habits of exile to the promise of home, naturally. Make yourself unconditionally available and trust that awakening will find you. So there's a sense of homecoming, of leaving the exile of our conditioned self, and the sense that there's something missing to coming back to. We have everything that we need. And we even have some to share with others. So I want to talk now about some ways of practicing with the refuges. There's the taking refuge is a part of our initiation ceremonies here. So on the outer level, that's what we do. We take the refuges, or we go for refuge in the presence of our friends and families and other practitioners. And it helps us at the Dharma Gate to do that, you know, to be sort of open about what we're about. So one way to look at working with refuges is just to look at what are you putting your refuge in now. You know, in terms of how do you, you know, spend your time? How do we spend our time? That's a way to look at it, you know. What do we really value? You know, what do we really value? We can look at, you know, that might sound kind of... I think if we do take a look at how we use our time, we'll realize that the amount of time we spent on our intention and on our inmost request is probably not so much on a day-to-day basis. But it's a good way to look at that, you know, and reflect on it and kind of renew our motivation and intention and get some energy to go forward. Because taking refuge on Buddha Dharma Sangha supports us being on a path. Instead of running into dead ends, we're on a path that's opening up to us, And so we're like the stream enterer, you know. The stream is not going to go backwards. It's going to just keep flowing till it reaches the sea and merges with the sea. So having an aspiration, having that refuge gives us it's a direction. It's a direction. So one way to just look at where we're at now and where we want to go is, what am I doing? What am I actually doing? And by looking at where we turn for relief, you know, turn the TV on or whatever it is that we do, we all do all kinds of things for relief from too much reality. You know, I like movies, Netflix, you know, but there's all kinds of things, you know, and they're okay, nothing wrong with them, but it's a good kind of, we can kind of see how to bring ourselves back when we take a look at how we're spending our time. Actually, sometimes when I do that, I'm kind of shocked. But I see how I'm using time on any given day. You know, try to be real intentional about it, but I keep getting distracted over and over again. And let's see, where am I? Oh, okay, yeah. And you know, in Soto Zen, we have some real specific ways of working with the refuges, like in Zen sewing. When we sew these garments, these little ritual objects that we wear, this mini robe, the raksu, we're taking refuge with every stitch that we put into it. And, you know, I think that's a really wonderful way, you know, to somehow mindfulness happens there, concentration is there, and also a sense of ease. Unless you just saw how your lack of mindfulness showed up in your stitches, and then and then it's just challenging. But I think the more I do that practice, the more enjoyable I find it, and the more I see it as a meditation in itself. And we're lucky that we have a teacher right here of sewing in our Sangha, Rosemary. Um, So another way that I've been using this refuges as a Dharma gate lately is just using it as a mantra, you know. And actually, I say using it, but it's almost been working through me. I'll be weak in the recent days, you know, contemplating this talk. I'll wake up with, and the refuges are in my mind first thing in the morning and before I go to bed, and it's kind of nice. You know, it's a nice thing to have in one's mind before going to sleep at night. And not bad to wake up with either. So I think it can function as a form of call and response in that way. When we use it as a mantra, in that it's a call out to our inner Buddha. And we respond from that place. So it's kind of like simultaneously, it could be like saying, help, you know, help, but also saying, here you go, here you are. So that's been enjoyable too. So the other day I was reading an article by a longtime Zen student who I think is probably a teacher now, Susan Moon. And in this article, she was talking about dealing with a really big challenge in her life, and some ways that she, for a while, she was just walking through the wilderness, and nothing helped her. Even her 30 years of sitting practice wasn't helpful for a time, until she got out of the thicket, the thickest part of the wilderness, and was able to then start benefiting from some of these practices. So she called her teacher, Reb Anderson, and asked him at some point to come visit her. And he came, and they were sitting on a park bench together, and he said to her, just try to remember that you're already supported by the entire universe. And so she took that as her mantra. It helped that it came, you know, the suggestion was from a teacher that she loved. And her version, her very simple version of the refuges, I will adopt for myself, because they're the most simple. I take refuge in my true nature. I take refuge in things as they are, appearing and disappearing as they are. I take refuge in the communities of which I'm part. Very simple. So simple, I might even remember it. And not to have to have 7 pages worth of notes. So, refuge, taking refuge as a Dharma gate, as a way of showing up, as a homecoming, and as a challenge. Interpenetrated, interrelated with all beings everywhere. That's pretty much what I have to say today about taking refuge. Whenever we look into one teaching, it just opens up. It opens up, and you can see all kinds of other teachings within that teaching, you know. So it's endless, endless opportunities Dharma gates are endless. If I were to realize them, at least look into them. And I vowed that I would find ways to get to put poetry into this talk, which I did, but also song, singing. So I want to ask you, those of you who know the tune and the words, to join me to serenade those who don't. with the singing the refuges in Pali, like we do at the end of the day in our sesshins sometimes, depending on who's choosing what we do. Okay, will you join me? Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Duryampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Duryampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Duryampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. See, that's why we enjoy doing that before going to sleep. So thank you for listening to this, and if you have anything you want to contribute or ask about, you could do that now.
Well, I was going to say that a friend of mine has been passing around a video, YouTube video, on Facebook. And it's about something called the overview effect. And a lot of it is focused on the experience of astronauts, who are, of course, home leaders of a significant order.
Mm-hmm.
And so while they're out on these voyages, of course, they have lots of things that they have to do at different times during the day, but there's also free time. And one of the things that happened from the very beginning is that the astronauts brought along cameras, and one of the first things they did was look back at the Earth and take pictures. And of course, this was the first time humanity had ever seen the Earth from that point of view before. And for many of these folks, it was a very moving experience because they were looking back at our home, and they realized both its great beauty and its fragility. One of the people in this video, many of these folks, of course, were trained scientists, but this guy was a physicist. And he was pointing out that, of course, he knows, or at least the current theory, the current story is, that the elements out of which our bodies are composed were originally generated within stars, and then they exploded and somehow reassembled themselves in planets, and out of these planets, like the Earth, that's where our bodies developed. So he got this real sense of interconnection and interdependence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Remember when we all saw those photographs for the first time? Yeah, how beautiful and moving it was for all of us to be able to see what Earth looked like. Yeah, thank you.
I was hoping you could repeat that other version of that you were talking about from the refuges, the taking refuge of
that. Was it a quote? Oh, Susan Lou? Oh, sure. Yeah, I obviously haven't memorize that yet. Yeah. Don't take refuge in your memory. Unreliable. Now and going forward. I take refuge in my true nature. I take refuge in things as they are. I take refuge in the communities of which I'm part. Anybody else? Oh, you're welcome, Arnie.
I got to see him twice. I didn't get to see him when he was here, did you?
No. No. I feel close to him. I haven't seen him. He's one of those people that I feel close to him through all his writings. And I've seen video, but it may not be necessary to meet him in person. He still seems real available. Yeah.
Thank you for the presentation. A little quick comment on the Gampopa one about entities not being separate.
Yeah.
And I once heard a comment on that that was to be kind, treat other people with loving kindness in yourself because other people are like you. And if you discover that other people don't exist, that's all the more reason to be kind to them because there's no reason not to be.
Good. Thanks. Any more jokes? Guy.
If you actually look at them, you know, half the vowels we make, they're actually outrageous.
Yeah, they are.
You know, beans are anomalous, bowing to freedom. We're going to all chant this later. Delusions are impossible. And so how do you found how do you work with those kinds of plants?
Well, they're called inconceivable vows, you know. So I think that they're so over the top, you know, that we go for it. Because I think human beings need a big challenge. We have a lot of big challenges, but in terms of our own putting out effort, you know, it's an arduous thing. But the fact that it's, you know, our practice can be arduous, but the fact that it's arduous is actually ennobling for us. Because it turns out that's how we're made up, that we need that things to be inconceivable and seemingly out of our reach and also arduous. That's my take on it. That's my story, and it could change tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, Katie. Yes, please do. Yeah.
I thought about this some also because I know some people feel that they can't. I've heard people say they can't articulate those vows because it would be dishonest because they know that what they're vowing is something they can't do. And so, if someone asked me that question, well, how can you vow to save all beings when you know it's impossible? And So there are many ways to look at this, but one would be for that one, since it's saving all beings. Well, who am I going to leave out? I mean,
who am I
not?
Right.
Who am I not going to?
Who are you not including?
Who am I going to eliminate? And also, it's like if I said I'm going to vow to save some beings, it's kind of the same thing. Well, okay, maybe I'll try to help you, or I'll try to help you, but not them. You know, and even in terms of our aspiration, if we limit it, like I'm going to try to accomplish these 10 tasks instead of everything, then our goal or our aspiration is much lower. In other words, if it's achievable, it's almost like it's too low an expectation.
Too low a bar. Could you hear that at all, Guy?
If it's achievable, the expectation is too low. It's like I need to give my whole mind, heart, and being to saving all, and only in that is it. Then it's endless. there's no end. In other words, it's good that I can't accomplish it, because if I could accomplish it, then that would end. But there is no end. It's like infinite.
It's infinite. It's inconceivable and it's endless. Yeah, and take the vows are going on endlessly. Yeah, that makes good sense. Thanks.
Don't you think that the vows also are acknowledging the boundless nature of all things? And just by reciting them, it opens us up to that boundlessness, which is not something we ordinarily can connect with.
Yeah, that's a good point. And providing we throw ourselves into the house of the vow, you know, that we're really in it when we're there, you know. So we're not just reciting something that is like words on a page, but we're really, it's the same idea with prostrations, you know, the Korean Zen teachers, you know, throwing oneself into the act of doing a prostration is how to let go of that small point of view and open up to what we don't normally notice, a bigger view that includes us but isn't focused in on us. Yeah.
And it also forces us to acknowledge the sentient being or the Dharma gate that's in our face right now that we don't want, that we really want to avoid. Oh, that's one too.
Another
way to maybe look at that is we really only need to save one being to save all beings.
Yeah. Start with this one.
Right? Or yeah.
Yeah.